Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Norse Theater here in San Francisco. Tremendous town, but horrible, horrible people. San Francisco has so many things going for it. At the moment, I can't think of any of them. It's amazing. Anything gets done in this town. These are the laziest people I've ever met. In 2020, San Francisco will go for Trump. Believe me. How are you guys up there? Wow. Absolutely incredible. Is this incredible? Tremendous. I'm so happy to be here. Someplace. This is someplace. I'm so happy you came out to see me for my never-ending victory tour and rally. So incredible. So incredible. You know, my Secret Service detail told me that there's over 25,000 people here tonight. 10,000 people outside who couldn't get in because the place is packed. But you know, the press, terrible people, the press. Aren't they horrible? Horrible people. Scum. Really are. They really are. They're going to say this is some theater in San Francisco and it's half full. Horrible. Horrible. Now, I've been very, very busy touring. I went to China. It's incredible. Incredible place, China. The people love me there. They're so tiny. They're so tiny. They make my hands look very, very big. I met Xi Jinping, or whatever his name is, and his lovely wife. His name is an accident. Why would you put an X in your kid's name? I never understand that. Shinzo Abe had hats made for me. Did you see the hats? So great. Just wonderful people. I went to Vietnam, and guess what? I wasn't captured. Did you see that? I left a free man. Went to South Korea. Very nice place. Great people. Good televisions, too, by the way. But we've been doing such amazing things in the government. We've gotten so much done. So fast. We're getting rid of the EPA. That's going to go. We're going to take that apart. Thank you. Thank you so much. They like that. We're going to get clean coal. Clean coal. It's great. It's great. We take the coal out of the ground. We wash it and we burn it. It's so incredible. Just scrub it right up. It burns so well. Fracking. Fracking's great. I don't know what it is. I just love saying fracking. It's so incredible. But I want to do a quick poll. You know, the next election's right around the corner. Now, by a round of applause, who here, this is the last election, who here would have voted for crooked Hillary Clinton? By a round of applause. Fantastic. Nobody could hear a pin drop. It was incredible. Now, who here will vote for me again in 2020? By a round of applause. Everybody. I love it. I love it. So incredible. Oh, by the way, are there any protesters here tonight? Any protesters? Just let me know. Couple? One or two? Trump people, beat the shit out of them. I'll pay your legal fees. But, you know, this town, it's, you know, we're going to build a wall around this town. We are going to build a wall around San Francisco and make Oakland pay for it. Because, frankly, that place is a dump, am I right? Terrible. Terrible. Thank you. Oakland's in the house. And we have a lot going on. Ivanka's husband, Jared, is that kid something else? He, what a smart kid. I've never heard him speak, but supposedly he's really... I don't know how that's possible. He's never spoken to me. Now, we've got a lot to cover tonight, but I just want to say to the people of Slate and Trumpcast, I want to thank them for giving me my $5 million presidential speaking fee. But I don't need it. I don't need it. I'm rich. I'm rich. I'm very, very rich. You guys know this. You know, not as rich as Putin, but you know. But I'm going to donate that money, that $5 million, to my favorite charity, Billionaires Without Borders. It makes it possible for billionaires and high-end millionaires. You see that? I'm very inclusive. It makes it possible for billionaires and high-end millionaires to travel the world and never have to come in contact with poor or unattractive people. So, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to bring on the people from Trumpcast right now. Are you ready? And you know why I love Trumpcast? Because it's all about me. It's all about me. Every episode, my name's in it. So first up, we have Jamel Bowie. Jamel, come on out here. Tremendous. Virginia Heffernan. Virginia. Wow, she's attractive. And that guy, Jacob Weisberg. Give him a nice round of applause. You guys, do what you have to do. I need to get some tweets out, if you know what I'm talking about. Thank you.
And this is the point at which we say, hello and welcome to Trumpcast. The show about the man who skipped out early on the East Asia Summit because it was running late and he'd already gotten so much done.
Donald Trump. I'm trying to do it like he does.
Nicely done. I'm Jacob Weisberg.
I'm Virginia Heffernan.
I'm Jamel Bowie.
And we are so excited to be here in San Francisco. This is a fantastic crowd. There was a... I follow the podcasting world very closely, and there was a study today that showed up in my inbox about the podcasting super listeners. I think you guys are the super listeners. The super listeners get a lot of their information from podcasts, but more to the point, they trust the information they get from podcasts more than any other media.
Terrible idea.
Yeah. It was really interesting. They don't trust cable news. They trust national newspapers, but they trust podcasts. Most of all.
One thing that I think is great about podcasts that you pointed out is our president does not listen to podcasts. And so it's, we're in like a Sami's dot. We can say what we want. We're among friends. Except for that guy.
This is a safe space for us, and it's going to be a great show tonight. We have a special guest who's going to be coming out in a little bit. We're going to be joined by Al Letson of the show Reveal. He's a writer. He's a journalist. He was a hero this summer in Berkeley when he stepped in to protect I don't know if we can say he was a Nazi. He might have been a Nazi, but it was an amazing story. Al's going to join us in a little bit. But first, you know, since I'm out here in the Bay Area for a couple days, I went over to see a tech company today. I went over to SurveyMonkey. SurveyMonkey, their head pollster is a guy called John Cohen, who used to be the head of polling for the Washington Post. And he said, you want me to do a survey for the show tonight? And I said, tonight? You can do it that fast? And he said, yeah, it's no problem. We have millions of people responding all the time. We'll just stick a question in. So I said, why don't we ask about Roy Moore? Why don't we see who believes Roy Moore and who thinks he should drop out? And this, I'm just going to give you the results because he just sent them to me an hour ago. And it's quite fascinating. We asked the question, as you know, Roy Moore has denied these accusations. Who do you believe more on the issue? And overall, 69% of 1,300 people they polled believe the women who made the accusations, and only 19% believe Roy Moore. But wait, get this. Among Republicans, 47% believe Roy Moore, only 40% believe the women, and among Republican men, and this is not in Alabama, this is in the country, 51% believe Roy Moore, and only 42% believe the women. And then, wait, this is interesting, and I don't think we've, I haven't seen this level of detail in the surveys about this. When we asked, should Roy Moore drop out of the Alabama Senate race, overall, 64% people said yes, 26% no. But the divide gets deeper, of course, when you look at Republicans and when you look at men. 60% of Republican men don't want him to drop out, but only 30% of Republican women think he should stay in. So even among Republicans, it's a big divide on Roy Moore.
You know, I know this is not how the SurveyMonkey surveys work, but in my head, I just imagine someone clicking through, you know, what's your favorite ice cream flavor? And then what do you think about the women who accuse Roy Moore of sexual
assault? Right, because they're like, we're asking millions of people all the time. Yeah, exactly. And some people didn't answer. So. Yeah.
But what do you make of that, Virginia? What do you make of this episode? I mean, we've had... with sexual harassment and sexual abuse in this country, we had a huge moment with the Access Hollywood and everything we found out about Donald Trump, and it was incredibly depressing and discouraging because it seemed that people didn't care, and he was elected president anyway. We had a moment with Harvey Weinstein. We're still in that moment that seems to send the opposite message. It's just sent shockwaves through our industry, through the media, through Hollywood. We're living through a kind of earthquake about it. Is Roy Moore another moment like that? And what is it going to mean?
I think it was watching from, I think I told you guys backstage, but a friend of mine was saying recently that she thought that the moment we normalized Donald Trump's hair, and you, go with me here, the moment we decided that that was an admissible hairstyle, like that he was sort of like that he
when did
passed
we do that?
The threshold. I mean, you know, what maybe on The Apprentice, but at some point you started to say that this like very strange hair belonged in whatever. And then it was like, we opened ourselves up. Then it was, all bets were off. We might start accepting anything. And we've kept thinking there's some kind of like ne plus ultra, like you can't go further than Access Hollywood, or you can't go further than, you know, evidence of obstruction of justice or collusion. And he keeps going past it. But at the same time, we have a narrative that there's some kind of base that will accept anything. So they accepted Sandy Hook without saying, you know, advocating for greater gun control. And they accepted, in this case, they might accept someone who has, you know, gone manifestly too far in every moral code, this guy, Roy Moore. There's no like special subset of, Southern honor that's reserved for men who rape teenagers. There's just like, there's no way to justify it. In some ways, I think the base is a fiction that we tell ourselves about people that will do anything, that will support anyone. I mean, the room actively hissed at the idea that someone would believe Roy Moore over his accusers. That, like, we've gotten into this idea that there's something very exciting about the base because they, you know, they're so punk, they'll do anything. And I think on a survey like this, I'm not sure that what they're saying is, I believe Roy Moore's denials of the charges that he like trolled malls looking for teenagers. I think they're saying something else. They're saying like, which is the punk vote? Which is the like, I'll do anything part of the survey? And, you know, the I'll support Trump, or I think Russia's fake news, or I don't believe the right thing I'm supposed to believe. I know I'm supposed to believe the women, but I don't.
But that's it. I mean, Jamel, what are they saying? Because, I mean, on the one hand, if they were saying, we forgive Roy Moore, it was a long time ago, I would disagree with that because it just seems to me that there's nothing worse than the sexual abuse of children. There's certain things you never get forgiven for. But if people said, we want to forgive him and elect him anyway, I can accept that. But they're not saying that. They're saying, we don't believe this evidence.
Right.
Right. And it's not, it's the evidence isn't iffy now. I mean, it's conclusive.
I mean, with the most recent accuser, she said, you know, Roy Moore signed my yearbook, which, by the way, I you know, what person who isn't 18 is signing yearbooks?
Yeah.
That, if nothing else.
You're like, that's
nothing
creepy.
Else.
That's an impeachable offense.
That's a warning yeah. sign.
If I came home to my wife and said, hey, I signed some teenage girl's yearbook, she'd be like,
right, you're out.
Well, I'm going to call the cops now. Like, that's how that works. So I think Virginia's right that to a certain extent, I think this is the I will say anything, like, you know, this question doesn't matter. I'm going to say the thing that's most transgressive effect. I think you saw that with the surveys over the course of Obama's presidency. You know, is Barack Obama a Muslim? Was he born in the United States? Obviously, some portion of the people who said yes to that, yes, that he was a Muslim, yes, that he was not born in the United States, really believed it. But I think some portion of people who said yes to those questions or agreed that or said that Obama was a Muslim were doing it just despite the question or despite the notion that they shouldn't hold those beliefs.
It's transgressive behavior. Right. It's what Virginia was saying.
Right, right. Yeah. So I think that's an element of it. But I also think there's this thing that's happening where outside of the world of political partisanship, I think people can hear an accusation and they believe it. They hear accusations against Weinstein and they believe it. They hear them against Louis C.K. and they believe it. But once it becomes a part of political partisanship, then that warps people's ability to have a reasonable opinion about this. And so if Roy Moore were just some guy, right,
yeah,
who wasn't running for office and this came out, I think a lot of the people saying they don't believe the women would believe the women. But because it's tied not just to Moore himself, but to the Republican Party, to how people who support Roy Moore think about themselves, they don't think about themselves as people who would support someone who molests children. So yeah. Obviously the charges must be false. That's what I think is, it leads to results like the one we see in the survey, where people, you know, don't believe the women. Although, again, I do want to say there are probably some of those respondents who 100% just don't believe the women. This is extremely anecdotal, but I got an email in my inbox yesterday morning that was sent at 3:25 a.m., and it was chastising me for the unrealistic moral code of not trying to groom teenagers to have sex with. So, you know, like...
right. Like
some people just are terrible.
Let he is without sin. Like, who hasn't greened to groom right. a teenager?
So, but to this point about the double standard, did we, and presumably a lot of people in the audience here, have a double standard about Bill Clinton? I mean, I've been kind of going back through that episode and asking myself whether I applied the standard to Bill Clinton that I'm now applying to Roy Moore and Donald Trump and everyone else. And the honest answer is no. I mean, I believed Paula Jones. I believe Kathleen Willey. I think the Juanita Broderick story I'm just not sure about that for various reasons. But in general, we knew Bill Clinton was a sexual harasser. I didn't have any doubt about that. There was no kind of like epistemic issue,
right,
to use the currently fashionable term. But at the same time, I thought it was ridiculous to talk about impeachment. I, you know, dismissed the larger importance. I mean, I was very angry at him for screwing up in this stupid way. But I sort of thought, well, that's his business. I think we'd look at it really differently now, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean...
But one thing that's been ingenious about the like ritual now crucifixion of all these male figures at the like late stage career, starting with Megan Toohey and Jodi Kantor's investigative piece, but also character assassination of Harvey Weinstein.
About Harvey Weinstein, yeah.
His obituary will never be the same. It'll be like Harvey Weinstein, who like spent a life serially abusing and assaulting women, produced movies, like paragraph 5, right? And the same is true for some of these other lions that we, you know, I don't think we'll soon forget Louis C.K. and so on. So we now know what it's like to take down a figure who, and Harvey Weinstein's incidentally on the left. And that while the New York Times is completely, you know, obsessed with Trump and the front and center, but how are we ever going to make something stick? You take down this peripheral figure on the left who, like, everybody's happy to let go. You know, we're not going to let them do that to Obama because there are never any flies on Obama anyway. Wasn't suggesting, but it's proxy and practice for what it's like to take down, I think, figures on the right. We didn't. There wasn't the same kind of expose associated with the O'Reilly story, associated with Roger Ailes. They kind of. We didn't. It wasn't as such a like sound and light show as the thing with Harvey Weinstein. And I really do think we're gearing up to, you know, we're gearing up to maybe relitigate some of the Clinton stuff, but also to see what it might be like to tell Donald Trump's story completely differently. Like, was the Trump organization just a money laundering, you know, money laundering organization, and has Trump like serially abused both the women and the men who've worked for him, sometimes in criminal ways? And, you know, his obituary would look very, very different if he were impeached or if these charges stuck than it would, you know, if he died today.
Trump
not
has it.
Saying
Trump has,
that he is, I want him yeah. to die today. I mean, I want him to live a healthy, happy life, but, you know, just this is
for the
counterfactual.
Record, he did not say that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
But Trump has at least one accuser who's trying to get into court to not relitigate it, but to litigate it right now.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think we could be going back there? Do you think this it's not over for Donald Trump?
So Rebecca Traister for New York Magazine had a really great piece in the immediate aftermath of the Weinstein expose, making the point that all of this is tied to the power of the perpetrator in particular. Weinstein at this point is still a somewhat powerful person in Hollywood, but he isn't who he once was.
Right, right.
And that diminished power opened him up to these accusations actually being taken seriously and litigated. The same is true of Bill Clinton, who has not been who's not stood for office in almost 20 years, or in 20 years period, and for as much as he's an in-demand speaker and a presence on the campaign trail, just isn't the figure he once was. With Trump, this is sort of why I'm not sure that there will be a relitigation or a litigation of the accusations against Trump, because he's still president of the United States. Mm. And that frankly buys him a level of immunity from these kinds of questions. Now, if it's the summer of 2020, or that's how you say that, 2020, if it's that summer and he has an approval rating of, you know, 30%, 25%, and it looks like he's going to lose, it's a little different. I think you may see something. But at the moment, I think what will happen is we will begin delving in to these accusations and histories with other men, and kind of the Trump question will just kind of remain in the background. Everyone will know what's there.
Right. And we'll know that these are dress rehearsals. Like, that maybe one day when we play the long game, we'll be able to get him. Also, it's possible that if Mueller enjoys the prosecutorial overreach that we're all hoping for, that he'll stumble on, just like the Whitewater investigation stumbled on Paula Jones and got the money, you know, moment of perjury. It could be possible that Mueller could turn up some of the hush money paid to women or something along those lines. But we've got it. There's plenty of other stuff.
I'll say again, though, that I think the partisanship question here is, like, really important.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, frankly, with Donald Trump in particular, I mean, obviously the guy harassed women, right? Like, it's not even really, you know. Even before the accusations last year, it was, like, obviously Donald Trump harassed women. At the least harassed women,
right?
Like, so, you know, if he were just a guy, if he were just some sort of fading celebrity, then there would have been no problem going after him. But as soon as he got wrapped up in this matrix of partisanship, then, you know, then there's an interest for one of the two major parties to defend him. And so, I mean, I kind of hope, you know, it would be important to break this, right? To sort of establish a norm that if a candidate is accused of, is credibly accused of sexual abuse, of sexual assault, then everyone kind of just kind of, like, you know, withdraws their support. That this goes past partisan competition. You just don't tolerate it. And so in that regard, it would be, I think it would be good to see a really intense sort of reevaluation of Bill Clinton, right? I mean, it's too late for doing anything when he was actually influential, but having that kind of on the board would be helpful in at least beginning to establish this norm so that in the future, if another presidential nom- if a dozen women come out and say, yeah, that dude sexually assaulted me, that there is no, that we all kind of recognize that partisanship doesn't matter here. That's unacceptable.
Yeah.
I think it's gotten a lot less survivable in the last several weeks.
We're acting like, oh, there are people who support Roy Moore and believe him, and that's terrible. I mean, we wouldn't have had this conversation. Like, you know, it took forever with John Edwards. We forgave Anthony Weiner. Like,
Did we forgive Anthony Weiner, though?
I mean, the first time. He ran
going
for
to
mayor
jail.
After. No.
Yeah,
I just
but, like, did you see that documentary, though?
Yeah. No, he was...
He ran for mayor.
A little unforgiven.
We got to wrap this up, but last question. Jamel, who's going to be the next U.S. Senator from Alabama? No one will remember. Now you're not saying it in the bright light.
I know. Say the thing you said back there.
Okay, so if I were flipping a coin right now, and I only could flip one coin.
I've got one, actually.
Then I would say Roy Moore probably wins.
Wait, flipping coins is not about predictions.
Listen. Just let me complete this thought.
Okay.
And now I'm not even going to complete this analogy to me because you're right. I don't know. Like, there's honestly a lot of variables at work that make it difficult, right? Because there has been a swing in the race. Even the most favorable Moore polls, one came out today that had Moore up 48-43. Previously, it had Moore up by 11 points. So there's a solid 5-point swing there at least. And that swing has been replicated through all the polling. So it's a kind of question of where do you begin your baseline? Do you begin your baseline with a double-digit Moore win or like a close single-digit Moore win? And if it's close single-digit, then Jones is likely ahead at this point. And it kind of just it honestly depends on how many white Republican Alabama voters just decide not to show up, to say, like, I can't pull a lever for a Democrat, but can't pull a lever for a guy who molests kids. Depending on how likely you think that happens should determine how likely you think Moore wins or not.
All right. That's it for our first topic.
Well, we're going to bring someone else out right now. You know him. You love him. Al Letson. Al, come on out here. Good to see you.
Al, we're happy to have you here. You know, when I think you've probably told this story more times than you want to, but I haven't had a chance to talk to you about it. You know, when I read about what happened in Berkeley in August, I just got choked up reading it because you reacted not like a journalist who was just there to watch, not like a guy who had a, you know, political point of view, but you
like
just
like an idiot.
Yeah, like an idiot. You saw somebody getting hurt and you stepped in, and it was amazing. But I just, like, what was going on that day?
You know, I have thought about this a lot, and I think there's a lot of different rationalizations that I could put on it. But the truth of the matter is I used to be a flight attendant. I was a flight attendant for about almost eight, nine years. And being a flight attendant, you know, I think a lot of people, when you get on the plane, you tend to think about being on a flight attendant as a person that brings you your Coke and your pretzels, and that's all good. But really, that's the difference between a flight attendant and a stewardess, is that a flight attendant is there to save your ass. So we spend a lot of time, like, training. And I felt like in that situation in Berkeley, like, all that flight attendant training just kicked in. And the first thing you're supposed to do as a flight attendant is assess the situation. And so I assessed, I saw that, you know, coming from one direction was, you know, a whole gang of people who were going to beat this guy up. I looked and saw the police weren't doing anything. I looked and saw that, the situation was just going to get worse. And then as a flight attendant, the next thing you're taught is you assess and then you move, you take action. And I found myself running over there and getting on top of him without even really thinking about it. Once I was on top of him, then it hit me like, oh, shit.
Because they were beating him with sticks.
Yeah, they were going at it.
You put your body between the sticks and him.
Yeah. So it was, you know, and to be honest, the minute I got on top of him, like, it seemed to kind of break the spell. I mean, there was a lot of people that were still hollering at him and you know, trying to punch him. But they didn't really hit me all that much. I mean, I got hit like once or twice and they were really, I could feel like they were pulling their blows. When I got on top of him, the first thought that came to my mind was to get my arm under his head. Cause I didn't want his head to hit the ground. And then the second thought was, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit.
Was oh shit you're going to be hit or oh shit
oh
he's
shit
a Nazi?
That I'm going to die. Like,
okay,
you know,
yeah.
Before it happened, like I thought he was going to die. And then I got on top of him and thought I was going to die.
Wow.
And so it was intense.
So what was it? Did that Nazi send you a thank you note?
You know, I wouldn't call him a Nazi. He tried.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call him a Nazi. I would say that he's on the spectrum. But not exactly
Nazi.
Nazi
curious.
Nazi curious.
Yeah. Asperger's.
He's there.
I'm just experimenting with that.
Yeah, just trying to see what that looks like. Yeah. You know, like, may not be a good fit for me.
What's his name?
Keith Campbell.
Keith Campbell.
And Keith reached out to me on Twitter. But I was really clear that I wanted to make sure that I controlled my own narrative. And so I was not going to have a kumbaya moment with him on Twitter, or Tucker Carlson kept asking me to come on, and I wasn't interested in that either. Because I knew what would happen is that... Thank you. I think the thing that frustrates me about... One of the things that frustrates me about America is that when we talk about racial issues, it's always on African Americans, on black people to forgive and to love and to be blah, 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 all this stuff. And I'm tired of that narrative. Like, I absolutely, you know, I saved him because I saw his humanity, but I'm also, we're not going to go to Denny's and hang out, you know, and we're not going to hug it out. You know, I think that after it happened, a friend of mine who was a journalist was there, a radio journalist with KQED, KLW, and she came up and asked me, because she didn't see what happened, she just saw me looking dazed, and my response to her was, she was like, what's wrong, and I told her what happened, and all I could say is like, oh my God, I did not want to be a part of the story, I don't want to be a part of the story. But I was, and so that was that. But then after that was all over with, then it was about being a journalist. And so for me, it was about holding Keith accountable for the things that he'd said and the things that he'd done.
Yeah, but also, I like, you know, one of the sort of moral dilemmas journalists deal with all the time is this sort of bystander problem. Like, in a way, you're sort of trained to not really be there, because if you were to start intervening, you couldn't be a good journalist. And you're sort of taught that when you're covering events, including, you know, wars and disasters, you know, you're not supposed to act like a human being.
Yeah.
And I like your version of it better.
Well, you know, I think prior to what happened in Berkeley, I may have agreed with that idea. But, you know, I think that there are things that, like, I really hold dear to me. Just some ideas that have stuck to me that I can't seem to shake. And one of those is Father Greg Boyle. He was just on Terry Gross like the other day. But I heard Father Greg Boyle like many, many years ago talking about what, you know, his philosophy. And one of the things that he said was he wanted to live like the truth is true and go where love has not yet arrived. And, you know, I was listening to Terry Gross. I was driving my car and I heard it and I just burst out into tears. I had to pull over because it, like, hit me so hard. And it's been this thing that, like, just kind of sticks with me. And sometimes I don't know what the truth is. I don't know. I mean, we live in this world where you're constantly asking yourself, like, what's true, what's not true. But I know the North Star for me is that, like, I want to see everybody's humanity, even if they can't see mine. Because it doesn't matter if they can't see mine. What matters to me is that I see theirs. You know, that's how I judge and value myself at the end of the day. So yeah, you know, I mean, it was crazy and ridiculous. And if given the exact same circumstances, I'd probably do it again. I don't suggest it for other journalists, and I don't I don't judge anybody by my ruler, right? Like several friends of mine were there. They actually filmed it, didn't realize it was me because they were like, "Who's that idiot?" and I think that they did what felt right for them, and I don't have any feelings either way about like them just filming and not taking part of it. I just know for me, if it had been a one-on-one fight, I would have stayed out of it. But it was like him versus like six other people, you know.
How did the people who were hitting him and hitting you respond to you after the fact?
Oh, they weren't happy. they were not happy.
So it must have been so confounding.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, so we live in this world where you can be on Twitter and anybody can tweet at you if it's unprotected.
Yeah.
So I realized, like, there was a day where I felt so bad because I felt like I was getting picked on by all of Antifa, and there were black people who were tweeting me, calling me a coon, and all sorts of crazy stuff. And then I realized, oh, it's just three people.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like three guys. Like, it's not the whole world.
Right.
You know, so yeah, but I mean, I've heard a lot of people have had, you know, I've talked to some of my friends, like one of my friends on Facebook, we were talking, we're buddies. I mean, he's my boy. And he was like, "Nah, bro, I wouldn't have done it." You know? And I'm not mad at him. Like, I get it. It's all good, you know? But for me, that was what felt right.
So I'm going to you sort of move this in a slightly more political direction, but I mean, we've grown up in a violent society, but we haven't grown up in a politically violent society, right? I mean, maybe Berkeley might be a little bit of an exception, but in general, we haven't experienced political. I've covered political events my whole career, and
I would disagree with you in the sense that, like, as an African American who grew up in the South, like all the violence that I was that I saw that was around me, that was political violence.
Yeah, I didn't phrase that right. Okay. Absolutely. I meant that we haven't had violence at political events, right? I mean, we have campaigns, elections, political protests.
I mean, we've had them in like little eruptions here and there, but not.
But we're getting a lot more of it now.
Right.
And the question is, are we moving to become a more violent political culture? And the threats of violence around the things that could happen politically. So, you know, we wanted to talk in this section a little bit about impeachment and the Democrats. And one of the things that's a backdrop to this, it's a question of why the Democrats aren't pushing impeachment harder right now. And one of the possibilities is that this implicit threat of violence, which has actually been a little bit of an explicit threat from some of the Trump people, that if you go there, there will be violence, is something that we haven't experienced before.
So, it's tough. Because I do want to spend some time on this question of political violence and like what is novel and what isn't. And I do feel like there's something novel about the present period. I do think that's the case, but I can't quite figure out how it's novel because it, you know, if you go back, 130 years, there was active violence during elections, during political events, organized by representatives of political parties. A guy like Ben Tillman of South Carolina, governor, later senator, who as just like a Democratic Party hack in the 1870s, like, you know, led campaigns of violence against black voters in South Carolina. His nickname was Pitchfork, Ben Pitchfork Tillman.
Jamel's doing a fantastic podcast on Reconstruction right now for Slate Plus members. And he knows a lot about this stuff.
This wasn't the backdoor plug. I have you, of course. there is this history of political violence, not both sort of happening from the institutional level, happening in sort of the ever present level that defines African American in the South relationship to the political system. And then we have this current period, which again is novel, and maybe it's just novel in the sense that the country's politics are so much more nationalized than they've ever been, and that fact gives any hint of political violence that comes from an organized or institutional space plays a different tenor than it did when politics were still like hyper-local, when there was like real plausible deniability throughout the system. That said, I think you're right that Democrats are really hesitant to talk about impeachment. I think they don't want to talk about it because they themselves have, it's within the memory of senior Democratic Party leaders of what happened the last time there was the real pursuit of impeachment against the president, and it was that Democrats in 1998 picked up seats in the Senate and the House, which wasn't supposed to happen.
So impeachment backfired right. in their favor. Yeah. Right. But are they just fighting the last war? I mean, why should they think or not think that that same thing would happen again, that if they pushed impeachment harder, that swing voters would say, that's ridiculous, we're going to stick by this guy because you're going so over right. the top?
I think what they're worried about is just that everyone's partisan sort of affiliation would kick in, and you know, Republicans, and of course any successful impeachment is going to have Republican support, and so Republicans are going to reject the entire project, and Republican voters will reject the entire project, and there's no reason to begin to sort of spend political capital on that particular thing. I think this presents like a legit problem. And a lot of political scientists and observers have noted that extreme polarization is having these crazy distortion effects from the way everything's supposed to work. And I think this is one of them, mm-hmm. That if things are so partisan and so polarized that obvious examples of misconduct aren't enough to trigger some kind of response, and that everyone's afraid of triggering it or attempting to trigger it because it would likely backfire, then essentially the accountability mechanism doesn't actually exist. And I don't know how... I think Democrats are genuinely caught in a dilemma of not knowing what to do about a political world where the president... let's just like lay it out. Not only is the president likely... you know, potentially party to a scheme to assist a foreign government in exchange for helping him get elected, bracket. But
our third topic.
Our third
we'll
topic.
Be back.
We'll
okay.
get back to yeah. that. But is actively siphoning the public funds into his own pocket. Just like it's a thing he does that we've all accepted. Like, oh, yeah, Trump's at his golf course again, making U.S. government agents buy rooms in his fancy right. estate amazing. And just kind of shoveling money. I mean, if Trump was not a billionaire when this all began, he will be a billionaire when it ends.
Did you see the wedding promotion, by the way, at the Trump golf course?
I did not.
Oh, yeah.
The pamphlet says... we can't promise the president will come to your wedding, but he might come. And if he comes, make sure you're respectful of his time and don't get him to pose for too many photos.
Your wedding,
but they're
right.
essentially selling the possibility right. of the president showing
show
up at your wedding.
Right.
It's part of the reason to book the golf course.
If I'm a Democrat, something that would be running through my head right now is the idea of replacing Trump with Mike Pence. Yes. I mean, Pence... would probably be able to get his legislation through better than Donald Trump would. So right now, like you've got a Trump administration that, you know, by all means is inept. They're not able to get their legislative ideas through. But you get Mike Pence, who, you know, some people would say is scarier than Trump because he's a true believer in a lot of the things that he says, right? The things that we know that like Trump doesn't actually really believe in, he just says because that's going to bring in voters, right? But Pence is a true believer. So if you have somebody like Pence who has experience working with Congress, you could see a lot of the things that Trump actually wants to get done actually happen under Pence. So if I'm a Democrat, I think you play opposition... and then you look to build in the incoming election.
Yeah, out here, there's a left base. Don't they? Aren't they going to demand impeachment? I mean, in the run up to the midterm election, aren't they going to say we got to get this guy out of office?
It depends. I think what happens in the midterm election really depends. I think on how people are going to look at it. But also, I think that on a whole, what the presidency of Trump has taught us is that Americans are really good with order. They don't want to shake stuff up. They don't, like, we're okay with watching all of these really bad things happening and not actually, like, pushing to do some real change. I mean, as a African-American in America, like, you could see that throughout the history, that, like, we are much more concerned with the idea of law and order than we are about justice, right? And so I think that what we see in the Trump administration is that the American people, like, on a whole, like, we get upset about it and we don't like it and we want to march or whatever, but, like, actually going and doing what needs to be done to make change, like, hasn't really happened yet.
I think there's a way to split the difference here between being afraid of alienating sort of the moderate suburban voters that Democrats are hoping on to win majorities, but then also holding Trump accountable. And that is, you know, if Dems take the House especially, but if they take either chamber, they'll all of a sudden be gifted with the subpoena powers of the United right. States Congress.
Everything changes.
Everything changes. You don't necessarily have to have impeachment. You can just have, like, I'll put it this way. Before the election, Republican lawmakers were openly saying, yeah, we're just going to investigate Hillary Clinton out the wazoo, right? Like, you know, we'll just make up stuff to investigate her because, like, we can do that. It just so happens
funny that, they're doing it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's true. They are. They just can't quit her.
Yeah.
But
if it works, you know, like, the hits keep coming.
It's like playing Freebird. They just got to do it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Everybody loves it.
Democrats will have the advantage of having a president in office who there is a legitimate constitutional question at issue, legitimate misdeeds happening. I mean, Virginia kind of mentioned this earlier, but we all saw the president tell Lester Holt on national television right. that he fired James Comey because of the Russia investigation. Like,
yeah.
I saw that with my own eyes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I saw Lester Holt kind of almost like look at the camera.
Right.
Like what?
Yeah, totally.
That was a freebie.
Re-watching. Right. Because he's also, anyway, I just think Lester Holt, he can save the Democratic Party. I mean, that was an amazing move, jiu-jitsu move, and it's worth watching over and over again. Also, not to mention, the conversation is originally about his investigation of voter fraud,
right.
which we now know WikiLeaks was gunning for Don Jr. to do. So he's taking Russian marching orders
conversation.
I know, but still.
We sat there
and watched that, right. which is
and
what
the
you're
point
saying.
Is that there's lots of fodder for legitimate investigations, and it's entirely plausible for Democrats not to pursue impeachment, but just to kind of pursue these investigations, not even in a sensational way, just like in a methodical, honest way. Like, these are questions we have to answer. This is potential wrongdoing. We're going to follow it to its conclusion.
All right. Thank you. That's it for the second topic. Al, you want to stay and talk about Russia? I'd like having you here. You weren't.
Sure, that's too good.
Just stick around. You don't need enough to. You were not warned. I want to continue the conversation because we're moving right into it, is all the stuff that's going on with Russia. And I think, you know, I spend so much time following this, from Virginia and Jamel, you guys spend so much time following this. I have a really hard time wrapping my head around it because it's just day by day there is stuff that is very hard to put in context and relate to everything else. I mean, just in the last, I don't know, 48 hours, we have this story about Don Jr. and Julian Assange slipping into the DMs,
the back room.
We have the story that the Russians sent 60 cash transfers to the embassy in Washington through Citibank, with the notation, for 2016 election.
Yeah, exactly. XOXO.
I think that's what you call hiding in plain sight.
Yes, exactly.
And I mean, what else is the new stuff?
But that Trump might have been asking Sessions to appoint a special prosecutor in exchange for keeping his job.
Trump did ask him that.
Right, but that itself is witness tampering or. No, sorry, the Papadopoulos. So many things are confusing.
Well,
there might be a witness tampering charge to do with Papadopoulos. It's the political abuse of prosecution.
I mean, for Trump to even make that suggestion that his political opponent should be prosecuted.
That's when we get into Banana Republic territory.
It's a ridiculous scenario.
You don't think she killed Vince Foster?
And it's not something, you don't need a special prosecutor to identify someone who ran for president before. I mean, she doesn't. The idea of a special prosecutor is you have to take someone out of the line of political pressure.
Right.
So Trump says, Hillary, the Justice Department, if it wants to investigate Hillary Clinton, it has a reason to investigate her, But never mind. What do you think matters of all this? I mean, as you look at this, you know, where is, if this story, the Russia story, is borne out, which are going to be the hot leads?
I mean, so in this hopefully near-term future, there is going to be an incredibly extraordinarily researched document called the Mueller Report, which is going to tell us the answers to all these questions. So in some ways...
Yeah, when can we read that?
Yeah, I know, exactly.
Before the election?
They keep pushing back the pub date.
It's like the winter.
Totally.
Never going to happen.
Shout out the Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah.
But so, you know, in some ways we're all trying, and it's not a leaky team down there. So we're not learning much from the SCIFs where they, you know, are processing incredible amounts
of...
Do you know what the SCIFs are? Does everyone know what the SCIFs are? Yeah, the SCIFs are for the real obsessives. They're the... Oh my God! Why do I know this? Okay, it's an architectural structure. Are these buildings that are completely like no Wi-Fi can escape them? They're like black holes, and they're what Mueller and his team works in. It's just like a level of titanium,
like the safe
room. Mud,
so just like a room,
you know,
circa 1990.
Stonehenge. A regular room in the 90s, exactly. Anyway, their walls are 10 feet thick and so on, and they. And they also, they can also withstand bombs and whatever. So anyway, they keep building more and more of them. And some of the Trump Russia obsessives will say, like, the helicopter spotted an extension built to the SCIF, which means, like, the investigation is, like, anyway, there's a podcast called The SCIF, if you really want to get into it.
really?
But, I think it's SCIFcast, I'm not kidding. But... In any case,
very derivative. Yeah.
They are doing work there that we, you know, obviously can only guess about. There have been some people have suspected leaks there. There have been no leaks there. So in some ways, we're just feeling around at something that will ultimately be told to us in Technicolor. At the same time, I think, and I hope Trumpcast has done some of this, obviously, there are great investigative journalists working on it. There are people who can give context, especially from the side of Russia, Turkey, the Saudis. You know, we've, Jacob, from the very beginning, got Ann Applebaum, Bill Browder, Ben Wittes, people to sort of speak to the larger context. What I think is really starting to come into relief with the Paradise Papers and with, sort of a new analysis after the arrest of Paul Manafort of what money laundering is really like a sense of how billionaires move money and don't pay taxes, and that also being a chief feature of making dirty money clean is basically, you know, what the Magnitsky Act is designed to prevent. The Magnitsky Act, to listeners of the podcast, is very familiar, but, you know, it's the thing that keeps Putin's blood money from finding a home here in the United States. So, like, if for specific human rights abusers cannot put their money in the United States...
Cannot buy apartments in Trump Tower anymore.
Buy apartments in Trump Tower anymore, exactly. And it drives Putin crazy because part of what the, like, shady demimonde of banking owes to the United States is an opportunity to, like, get clean and, like, get in circulation and you can spend it and, you know... I thought that Adam Davidson interview you did, Jacob, was just so good at getting in the details. It's a $7 trillion business, money laundering. I mean, it's gigantic. And then you start to think, and this is where I think it bears on the Russia investigation, oh, that's what this world of, like, not quite bankers who have tens of millions of dollars that are like Paul Manafort are doing when they broker weird deals, you know, Ukrainian blood money, then he buys a ton of, Tabriz rugs and suits to launder the money, you know, $1 million almost in what at a place that seemed like ABC carpet. Like, that is how these guys That is how these guys have been living for a long time. And I just had no idea there were so many of them. And I had no idea. I mean, the Paradise Papers is just this trove of just, you know, billionaires and what did he call them, like higher end millionaires. I feel like getting that larger context as Mueller fills in the smaller details is really interesting. I mean, you know,
but a lot of this is going to hinge on whether they can flip, say, a Flynn.
So right? You want to get right into the weeds, yes.
I mean, at the end of the day, to bring a case, you have to have a witness.
Right.
And you need a high-level witness.
Right.
And I don't think it's going to be Jared. Papadopoulos seems, he's
given us a lot.
He's working for them, but
right.
he was pretty low-level as one of these weird characters. But Flynn was the National Security Advisor, and this story that they were had this kind of privatized rendition scheme, which is completely insane.
Yep.
But that's, it looked a little bit like, I think this was Preet Bharara's theory.
Yeah.
They're showing him what they got.
Yep.
And it's like, you want to work with us or you want to stand trial?
And they're putting pressure on Flynn's son. I mean, that's the pressure point with Flynn, right?
He's a great guy. I mean, he's another junior that we all really love and respect.
Right. I mean, I think it's worth, you began this conversation, Jacob, asking like which of all these facts is gonna matter. And I think it's worth saying that what we know publicly, I think, is what people were thinking when the word collusion got thrown out earlier in the year. That sort of, it is very clear based on just public knowledge that there are people within the Trump administration actively talking to agents of the Russian government to collect information to use in the election. Now, whether the question is like whether that's illegal or not, and like, you know, who knows, or I don't know, but you know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So I think that's just worth saying that even if we learn nothing else, we're already kind of looking at one of the biggest political scandals, potentially quite larger than Watergate. And it doesn't like it yet, but I think that's where we are. But the other thing, and I said this to you guys before we got started, my kind of guiding light on all of this is no one is going to jail for Donald Trump.
Yeah, that I found that very interesting.
No one is going to go to jail for Donald Trump. And so I expect people to flip because
George Papadopoulos is the first canary in the coal mine for this.
Like, so
he was going to go to jail for Donald Trump. He had the blank check. He lied to the FBI, and then he was just like, I don't want to go to jail for Donald Trump.
I recently read an article though about it was somebody who had worked for Mueller at one point, and at the end of the article he said basically that career criminals are not going to flip. Like, because, like, a Manafort is not going to flip because he knows that if he flips, those people are going to see his family, right? Like, the people, the Russians or whoever the big bad is, right? Not necessarily Trump, but the hand behind it all, right? But that the lower
people
will.
This is like Narcos.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like, they will come for your family. So it's like, Manafort is not necessarily going to go to jail for Trump.
Although his daughter's already flipped on him, Manafort's daughter.
So he
might flip and just cut the daughters loose.
I think the big thing with all of this, though, and to go back to something that Jamel brought up earlier, is that, you know, chaos is a ladder, and he has won. Putin has won. He is the little finger of Game of Thrones playing right now.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean,
but
you know, spoiler alert.
If you haven't caught up with Game of Thrones at this point, that's on you.
I mean, a little.
Maybe we shouldn't ask you to stay. We're going to hear about that.
I didn't say what happened, Littlefinger.
I'm just saying Littlefinger, you know, he got caught.
He's the one who brought it up.
All right,
what I'm saying is that chaos is a ladder, and all Putin needs is America to turn in on itself. All it needs is for all these investigations happening. All it needs is for a president who begins to get us into this isolationist mode, which weakens then NATO, which allows him to do, which allows Putin to do whatever he wants to with those former Soviet states, right? So that's what the big game is.
He's
already won in that aspect.
Do we have still a little minute on this, or not so much?
This will be the last word, and then I've got a question for you guys to take the last substantive comment.
Okay, so I have been obsessed with yesterday's news. It literally is yesterday's news in the sense that it's gone, but it also happened yesterday, which is the smashing of the Keurig coffee machines. so, So this is...
Keurignacht.
Keurignacht, exactly. Oh my God. I want to end there, but I just have to make my point. So Keurignacht, as we all know it. So yesterday, the Hamilton 68 dashboard, I refer to it all the time, Securing Democracy's project of putting up the number, you know, the top 10 hashtags pushed by bots, has boycott Keurig at maybe 10 a.m. comes up as their number two hashtag after MAGA, which is always number one. And then five videos of men all looking very similar in garages smashing coffee machines comes up. And they actually are not ideological. Like I don't know. My suspicion is they were each given $1,000 on a coffee machine and told to smash it, and the videos were put up because they don't actually mention Roy Moore and Hannity and so on. Okay, so those things circulate on online media, and the hashtag is everywhere, boycott Keurig. So then we, like normal people or whatever, people formerly people on the left, now people that are normal at all, look at that and are like, wow, these people are so crazy. Keurig boycotted Hannity. Hannity defended Roy Moore. Roy Moore is a child molester. These people are willing to destroy their expensive coffee machines because they love Roy Moore, the child molester. That is how weird the base is. NPR, love NPR, but NPR does a story with exactly that. This base is so exciting and interesting, and we're so enthralled to them that we're going to watch them wreck their coffee machines and then talk about how horrible they are and whatever. And by the end of the day, Keurig is back, walked back their thing. They're kind of in with Hannity again. Their stock price has gone... Everybody's frantic in a panic at Keurig. Anyone lost soul looking to join the base is like, the base is more charismatic than ever. They hold the mainstream media in fear and trembling. And everyone on the left is just like, wow, they're all such idiots and insane, and they're armed, and they ruin their Keurig machines, and they'll do anything. And honestly, that is a Putin win that you can chronicle. Like, he put that hashtag up first thing in the morning. We can't do that anymore. Like, and this is NPR, like people who should know better.
Can I just say that if I were responsible for covering this story, it would simply be smash a Keurig machine. It's terrible.
Because I mean, the coffee.
Keurig coffee is
well,
bad.
There was also, there's
Keurig
also
is
that.
Wasteful.
There is smash, also that.
So, hey, you like child monsters? Smash a Keurig machine. You don't? Smash a Keurig machine.
There was a lot of jokes about
we would love it if you guys have some questions, but while you maybe come up and gather your thoughts, quick fun question for you guys. In this Russia scandal, who's the dumbest player? I mean, this has been a competition underway, right?
I mean, if I get to go first, it's just a bullseye for Carter Page. Just, I mean, the marionette smile. I mean, you teed that up for me too easily. But just the marionette smile, the being his own wiretap, like any, you know, just like constantly confessing. And there's actually there's a name for a witness like him who's cognitively impaired.
Yeah. And who, I mean, when he in the Senate, Intelligence Committee hearings when he bragged about having elite status on Delta.
Unbelievable.
I kind of thought maybe there's an issue here.
I'm for Carter.
Yeah, Page, Carter Page. Yep. All right, Jamel?
America's greatest fail son, Don Jr.
Oh, yeah, no, he's a sweetheart.
I mean,
it's answering the DM from Julian
it's
Assange.
It's answering the DM from Julian Assange. There was a time a couple months ago when he just sort of like posted a bunch of emails on his account like they vindicated him, and they did not. I feel like last year, I had this conversation with a lot of people last year. It's like, who's the dumbest Trump kid? Assuming they're all dumb, who is the Job of the group, right? The Job Bluth.
Right.
And at the time, it was like, well, Eric is obviously the Job Bluth. But I think it's John. It's Don. Don's the Job
yeah,
Bluth.
Yeah, yeah.
He is the dumbest one. And his role in the Russia scandal vindicates that completely. Again, America's greatest fail son.
It's Tiffany Tiffany, a lot of space, Ivanka, Eric, and Don Jr., right?
No.
Okay.
I think you gotta look at this like the Bluth family, right? They're all dumb, but it's just varying degrees of it. So like Ivanka's your Michael Bluth, like, you know, superficially not dumb, but in fact dumb. Portia de Rossi's character is like Tiffany and Eric. and then Don Jr.
You're like looking Joe. Down.
So, all right, well, I'm going to give you, you know, we haven't heard a lot from him lately, but don't forget about Seb Gorka.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Oh, yeah, Gorka.
No.
There is no wear your dad's Nazi medals to work day. Like, that's not catching on.
I mean, I want to say a word in his defense. He accidentally said President Clinton, speaking of Hillary Clinton, everybody's terrifying grandmother, and I think he might have known something we don't know. I was just like,
well, what about Paul
I
Manafort?
Think she's the rightful president. He
yeah.
thinks she's the rightful
I mean,
president.
Paul,
okay,
Paul
you're
going to
say the dumbest?
Well, I mean, if you are doing money laundering, why would you then decide to run the campaign of the possible president of the United States? Everybody's going to be looking at you. Like, money
right.
laundering is something you do in the dark and you don't tell your friends. But suddenly, you're out and about and you're the head of this campaign and everybody's looking at you now. So it's like putting the spotlight on someone who wants to be in the shadows. That doesn't make sense to me.
And he ripped off an oligarch, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
not a longevity
not smart.
Strategy.
Not
I mean, Deripaska gave him money to invest and he disappeared with
yeah.
that.
Yeah, Paul Manafort totally
is
100% like an extra. He gets God in John Wick.
Right.
Just like,
yeah.
Who's got a question for us? It's a little hard to see up here, but I'm hoping there's some microphones.
It looks like they
are,
right?
I'm going to encourage you to ask very brief questions
House
that
light.
Are questions.
Hey. So you mentioned this weird extradition scheme that there's this long history with Fethullah Gulen
yep.
being in the U.S. Like, I sometimes wonder, like, how should we as sort of liberal humanists feel about Fethullah Gulen, who seems like he's sort of a moderate Islamist, that he wants to maybe advocate a version of politics that's sort of the equivalent of Christian democracy in Germany for like Islamic democracy. But like there's a weird cult of personality around him as well. And I'm not sure. So like he's sort of been brought into the Trump story and he's such an interesting character. And I wonder if you guys have thoughts.
Like, do you actually connect the dots on what Ben Wittes calls l'affaire Turc?
Can you just summarize? I'll give a little bit of background on Turk. I mean, this is the guy that Flynn and his son were, according to this latest accusation, talking about kidnapping, who Erdogan, the Turkish president, wants back because he sees him as the center of this cabal behind the coup and everything else. The Gulenists, I've been to Turkey a couple times. It's very hard to understand. I mean, the best I've been able to get a grip on it, the Gulenists are like the Mormons of Turkey, right? They're very clean cut. They're great. They're very professional. They do everything really well. But there's this... They make people. They make. This is not a slur on Mormonism, but there is. There is a religious mainstream around them that has not fully accepted them. Right. I mean, the way that they're Christians who don't believe Mormons are Christians. There is suspicion.
They don't have their Mitt Romney yet.
Exactly what they're up to, and it's this weird. It's about Turkish politics. It has nothing to do with American politics, and. You know, I think it's such a conspiratorial culture, that political culture, that I don't think we're ever going to make sense out of it. We're just going to get the little piece of it we get.
But this could be, Andrew Weissman could be using this to flip Flynn. I mean, it's like, yeah. I don't know anything about flipping witnesses, but I would say we have you on kidnapping. It would be like kind of a good way to get a plea, right?
I want to get as many of these in as possible, so let's go to this side. We'll go back and forth.
I got two questions.
No, just one.
Just one?
Yeah.
I promise you they're both good. Okay, but you guys talk about, well, Mike Pence would be just as bad, if not worse, but I just don't think Mike Pence would be a dictator. I mean, I don't fear we would have a burning of the Reichstag under Mike Pence. And look, I'd never... in a million years would want Pence, but...
All right, so I'm going to let Virginia answer that because she agrees with you.
I'm a Pence is not as bad, or Pence is not certainly not worse person, and I kind of feel like I was there. I've just always been there, but I also think post-impeachment, he'll have to serve out the shift. He'll have a lot of work to do rebuilding the party, and he'll, I think, go quietly. He's not an effective person. He wasn't effective in Indiana. He can't get anything done. All he cares about is the genocide of the unborn and his, like, pious smarminess. And he will... oops, was that wrong? And he... I forget sometimes. No, you guys are pretty ready to go on that. And I hopefully he'll just, like, you know, clock out, turn off the lights, and they'll disappear forever. I think, I think if he were an elected, if he were the elected president, the country would be in, like, you know, would be in a horrible place, and he would have, you know, a lot of leeway to, like, remake a conservative Christian, you know,
but
gulag.
I think when you say that, though, that is kind of like looking at the rules that we had, you know, a year and a half ago, right? And I think that we've now seen that, like, the Senate basically stole a Supreme Court seat, right? Like, they decided that they just were not playing anymore, right? And so, like, I think that all the things, what Trump has done for America is it has proven to us that all the things that we thought were laws and rules were actually just traditions. And traditions can be ignored and pushed aside. So I think that if Mike Pence got in, he would push to create that Christian idea of what America should be, because I think that that's what he truly believes. And so if he truly believes that, he has to go forward. The other side of that is, and this is just me, you know, throwing out some ideas, but I think that the thing that drives the Republican leadership crazy about Trump is that they can't control him.
Yeah.
I think that Mike Pence is controllable in a way that Donald Trump isn't. And if Mike Pence is controllable in a way that Donald Trump isn't, then their legislative agenda can be pushed forward in a way that it could never happen with Donald Trump. I'm not saying that, like, you know, he's as bad as Trump or anything of that nature. I'm just saying that, like, there's two different paths here. And if I'm a Democrat in the House or in the Senate, I'm thinking about those things.
Yep.
Next question.
Hi, I'm a student from the University of San Francisco, so really happy to be here. I also do a podcast called Trump 101, so similar name there, appreciate it. Here's my question. Virginia, I really like that you brought up how frustrating it is that a couple of bots can start a hashtag that starts a 24-hour news cycle on it. But my question is, what can Twitter be doing to stop that from happening?
There may be some people in the audience who can answer that question.
Yeah, exactly, right. This is a Twitter hometown. I think that I worry, I think I'm partisan on this. I prefer, with no good reason, the fast metabolism of Twitter to the, like, slow, depressed metabolism of Facebook. So I feel like it's a choice between leukemia and lupus. Like, you're either, like, immunodepressed or, like, immuno-overactive. And so I've cleared off Facebook because, you know, 200 million, 20% fraud accounts on Facebook. It's always in the margins of your experience on Facebook, and people are slow to take it in. There's something in that, like, suburban UX look that, and the proximity to your aunts and stuff that makes you tired and makes you, like, believe things you wouldn't believe. Twitter, on the other hand, you know, something comes up and it's crazy how fast people move. You guys all know this, but they'll, like, have the perfect GIF, and then they'll be like, this tweet hasn't aged well, and they'll have something from Donald Trump in 2012. And you just are like, how did this all happen so fast? And obviously, if you import bot cliche, if you use bot cliches the way the NPR did, you know, people will be on you like a pack of wolves, depending on, you know, how much you, you know, follow. I'm finding bots easier to identify, and obviously they take different forms. Just as a, like, buyer beware, if you're on Twitter, there are, like, certain nice self-defense tactics that, you know, I can talk to you about, but also securing democracy. Molly McHugh is really good on this. Following the people that, like, are trying to sort of, just from the point of view of the consumer, defend yourself. What can Twitter do? I mean, Twitter and Facebook are going to have to accept that they are going to take a cut in, like, what they say are their monthly active users, because fraught 20% on Facebook. Like, if that drives the stock price down, they still have to admit to it, that they don't have 2 billion monthly active users. I mean, that is like just a huge sea change in how we see them. And Twitter's the same. And if, I mean, First is just like making a clean breast of it, changing it on their sites, changing it in their, like, you know, quarterly reports, and taking their licks for that.
Yeah. I mean, my initial answer to that is nationalize Twitter. And I mean that quite seriously.
Yeah. America first, Twitter.
To recognize that Twitter and Facebook are part of the public infrastructure, just like the internet, just like railroads, just like electricity, and like democratize them and take democratic accountability seriously. But that's probably not really in the offing. So realistically, I think what Twitter can do is a bunch of things. Like Virginia said, first, be honest with itself that much of the activity on the platform is coming from bots, or if they are people, like, you know, lots of activity from Nazis, and saying that we don't want that on our platform, that in fact, there's nothing... You know, there's this tension, right, that, you know, you want to respect free speech rights versus kind of protecting kind of like a public commons. But there's nothing about even sort of a near absolutist view of free speech rights that requires a private company like Twitter, even a private one that is running this public commons, to accommodate views and accommodate entities that are demonstrably harmful to that public common. So I think Twitter has within its power and should just begin to clean up the service of bots and of hate groups and the like. But I think one very concrete thing Twitter could do is to take verification and essentially make it universal. And to say that if you want to use this service to the fullest, you have to be verified. And being verified means verifying your email address, your phone number, like verifying actual personal information.
Blue checks for everyone.
Right, for everyone. Yeah. Everyone gets a blue check, yeah.
Or TSA pre-check, like you really have to go for it.
And if you don't do that, then Twitter is like nerfed, right? And you can't, it is like a less valuable platform for those who don't do that. So that would be my, it goes in this order, if not communism for Twitter, then, you know, just like verification for everyone.
Well, or like total elitism,
right,
like Augusta.
You guys,
yeah.
You guys, we got to get a few more.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
First of all, big TrumpCast fan.
Thank you.
I'm really interested, though, and I think Al's point was really well taken about Gorsuch. And I think we talk a lot about Trump as a buffoon, but I think the cadre of people who've put him up and are reaping so much benefit from it are reaping a lot of benefit, and we're having a lot of negative impact. So I'm interested in hearing from each of you, what's the worst thing that he's accomplished so far? Whether it's deregulation, attack on abortion. I could go on and on, but I think too often this administration is cast as do nothing when there's a long-term impact that needs to be discussed by brilliant people like yourselves. Thank you.
And thank you for the kind words. I'll go first. I think, you know, there has been an absence of major legislative accomplishments, but I agree with you that doesn't mean he's done nothing. But I think what he's done is very broad. I think it has to do with tremendous damage to American political culture and the American political system. And he's spread distrust. He's spread, you know, every kind of political harm almost that you can. How permanent that is remains to be seen, because something that's not a legal change can change back with a different kind of leadership. I mean, if Barack Obama was president again, you know, you could see that kind of damage possibly reversed very quickly. So I think it is important to not dismiss what he's done, but it's also important not to overestimate it.
I mean, the damage to the truth, the damage to the, like, values of democracy seem to be the worst. But since you were asking about policy things, you know, he's put another fox in charge of the hen house with the FDA. And obviously the EPA and HUD, you know, Ben Carson is a very intelligent brilliant, interestingly, cognitively interesting person who has, undone a lot at HUD, as I understand it, in ways that have, dampened their proactive initiatives, which has happened also, obviously, with the, in education.
Saying brain surgeon, heal thyself?
Brain surgeon, yes, exactly. Get in there with the scalpel and make something happen, Ben. Pulling out of the Paris Accords and also the damage to the EPA are, I don't know, like we keep thinking that we're going to repair that stuff, that like Mueller, it's, I don't know what it feels like, letting up on the gas and the up on the clutch or whatever, but it just feels like, please, Mueller, bring this thing to a halt before, because we can't right now concentrate on the, on the destruction of the EPA or the destruction of the of HUD or the FDA or like, it's just like all coming too fast. But yeah, I don't know how quickly those things will heal themselves.
You want a quick one, Jamal?
Yeah, sure. I'm just going to say Gorsuch. And not just Gorsuch, but the federal judiciary in general. And I, My sort of worry here is that I think stealing a Supreme Court seat, refusing to actually exercise the advise and consent requirement to save a seat for a Republican president, essentially doing the same for all sorts of circuit and district court judges, I think there's a real case you can make that those, let's just say Gorsuch, is an illegitimate judge and that should be removed. I think that's a real legitimate political case you can make. And so part of the reason why I say, why I focus on the judgeships here isn't just because of these are lifetime appointments and long-term impact, but I don't think anyone's going to pursue that argument. I don't think anyone in politics is going to make openly the case that, we have to kind of do a do-over. Like what I would like to see is someone to say straight up that like the process that led to Gorsuch's nomination was illegitimate and that every decision that Gorsuch is a deciding vote in needs to essentially be reconsidered. That this constitutes a crisis of the judicial system that we have to do something about. And it's precisely because I think that crisis is real and major that I think just simply, that is the worst thing. And it's going to have the longest term impact on American governance going forward.
You've got the last quick question.
Oh, great. Thank you.
No.
Well, thank
Sorry.
You.
We're over time.
Thank you so much for the discussion. I also, as well as Ali that asked a question before me, also do a podcast about Trump. So I really appreciate you guys doing this. It's important work. My question has to do with a Russia investigation. I share, as probably a lot of people here do, that it's an important issue. Obviously, it's something we have to investigate. But at what point do we become the people with the tinfoil hats on? How do we not get into the realm of becoming conspiracy theorists and going after things that sometimes might be false as well?
I think it's a good warning, even more than a good question. And I think the answer is you've got to not let what you want to believe determine what you do believe. And, I think, look, I think there are going to be articles of impeachment about Trump. And Jamal was making this point. I think there are very strong ones already around corruption, conflict of interest, and obstruction of justice. I'm not sure there'll be one about Russia. I mean, I think as bad and as stupid as their behavior was, it's still up in the air whether this was something that Trump was actively involved in. I don't think it needs. I think it's a strong case without it. But to me, the important point is the way he has tried to prevent an investigation, because only with a real investigation can we know. We're not getting that real investigation in Congress because of the way the Republican Party is deferring to him. And so that's the problem right now. But at the end of the day, was there an impeachable crime committed there? I just don't think we know yet.
Yeah. I mean, I'm inclined to say that the Russian investigation is important, but that I think part of what might be encouraging conspiratorial views is the belief that it will lead to Trump's removal. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that's going to happen. I think that Trump will serve out his 4 years, and if he's removed, it will be through an election, and that's it. And so taking that view is one way to keep from getting into conspiratorial thinking, recognizing that nothing is going to just make Trump go away, that the only thing that will make Trump go away is like the organized democratic activity of citizens.
Unless you need a last, do you want a last word, or you?
Well, I'll say one thing, which is that, you know, 1 year ago, our country and our minds sustained a very painful insult and assault on it. And the brains have worked in many, many ways. Like you and we did a podcast about it. But one of the ways to try to like make the rough places plain in our brains has been this sort of proliferation of armchair Encyclopedia Browns trying to crack Trump Russia and getting increasingly paranoid sounding with like elaborate theories. I caution against it just as like a mental health practice, because it doesn't have a good track record in past paranoid times in the United States of like engendering change or, you know, solving for yourself the like painful places in your brain. But I guess I recognize the impulse, you know. I mean, I've definitely gone down a few rabbit holes in thinking about Trump Russia myself, I'll admit it. And I don't not follow Louise Mensch. I don't block her. Let's just say that. Anyway.
You don't believe her, I hope. That's it for tonight's show. I want to thank Sean DiDomenico.
Thank you.
I want to thank Al Letson. I want to thank our producer, Jason DeLeon. I want to thank Kristen Holtz, who put this event together for us. I want to thank the wonderful staff at the Norris Theater. And I want to thank all of you for being here. For Jamel Bowie, for Virginia Heffernan, I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to
Trumpcast.
One.